Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Very excited about this. Good evening, and welcome to this evening's meeting of the Commonwealth Club. The club is online at commonwealthclub.org, as well as on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. As you heard, I'm Courtney Martin, and I'm an author and entrepreneur. I wrote a book called The New Better Off, Reinventing the American Dream, where I grappled with some of the issues that we're going to talk about tonight. And it's my pleasure to introduce Mark Friedman to discuss his new book, How to Live Forever, which is a pretty exciting promise. But the non-Silicon Valley version, obviously. And if you're here, you probably already know that. No cryogenics tonight. Before we start our conversation, I wanted to give a little background on this incredible man. As many here probably know, Mark is one of the nation's leading experts on the longevity revolution and how the country can benefit from the experience of our growing older adult population. He is currently founder and CEO of an amazing organization, Encore.org, a member of the Wall Street Journal's experts panel, and a frequent commentator in the media and the author of four previous books. Originator of the Encore career idea linking older adults to the greater good, Friedman co-founded the Experience Corps program to mobilize people over 50 to improve the school performance and prospects of low-income elementary school students in 22 U.S. cities. He also spearheaded the creation of the Encore Fellowships program, a one-year fellowship helping individuals translate their midlife skills into second acts focused on social impact, and the Purpose Prize, an annual $100,000 prize for social entrepreneurs in the second half of life. If you want to feel the opposite of how you feel reading the day's headlines, you should cue yourself into the Purpose Prize, because every time it's announced, I like revel in reading what these incredible humans are doing. AARP now runs both Experience Corps and the Purpose Prize, by the way. Mark was named Social Entrepreneur of the Year by the World Economic Forum. He was recognized as one of the nation's leading social entrepreneurs by Fast Company magazine 3 years in a row, and has been honored with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship. He has been a visiting scholar at Stanford, the David and Lucille Packard Foundation. You get it. This guy is legit, awarded, interesting, beloved. So we're so lucky to be with him. He also happens to be a friend. We both live in the East Bay and have had, you know, many incredible conversations at coffee shops there. So on a personal level, I feel very grateful to be here with you. So let's begin. So it's 2019. Did everyone cue into that fact? I'm still writing 2018 down on my checks. The first time in American history that we've had more old people than young ones in this society. We want to explore tonight sort of the dangers and the possibilities in that. So first, let's talk a little bit about the downsides, kind of the dangers. You write so compellingly about age segregation in particular, and the ways in which something that we sort of, many of us accept as normal, is actually not normal at all, is quite a new invention. Will you start off talking a little bit about how age segregation became so normalized?
It feels like it's the oxygen in the air, that people of different ages should be in different settings and institutions, and the twains should never meet. But in fact, it's a relatively recent development. We went in the course of the 20th century from being the most age-integrated society in the world to being the most age-segregated, to a kind of age apartheid. Wouldn't even be an exaggeration. And it's amazing if you go back, and I don't want to wax nostalgic about the 19th century and say that it should be the guide for the 21st, but there was no sense of chronological age in America 100 years ago. People actually had no idea how old they were or other people were. Birthdays weren't celebrated. It would be, knowing somebody's age would be like knowing somebody's blood type. Today, the birthday song wasn't even invented until 1934. You know, happy birthday to you. And society was thoroughly integrated by age. It was an agrarian economy. Older and younger people worked side by side on the farmstead. One-room schoolhouses had children, but they also had people in their 30s and 40s. And multi-generational households were the norm. And then beginning in the early part of the 20th century, oftentimes for the most understandable reasons, we reshuffled the deck of society so that we put young people in education institutions, middle people in the workplace and older people in the golf course or the nursing home, or and I'm not being facetious when I say, for the best reason, things like universal schooling, child labor laws,
right?
Social Security was probably, to my mind, the greatest policy achievement of the last century, but it also created this incentive to get older people out of the workplace at a time when jobs were scarce and we were worried about social upheaval with so many young people out of work. But the end result is what somebody recently described as a grievous wound that we've inflicted upon ourselves. And it's probably no surprise after this reshuffling of society that we've lost a sense of the wholeness of life, that there's, people are worried about conflict between the generations, kids versus Keynes, that ageism is rampant, and that the two loneliest groups in society, according to a new UCLA study, are younger people and older people.
Right. Well, and you started to kind of tease this out, but one of the things I found really interesting that you explore in the book is one of the ways age segregation got so codified was from a good place, was from like a human rights perspective of let's get kids into schools and let's make sure they're not in the labor force and let's, you know, create Social Security and all these things. But the other threat is really consumeristic, right? Is how can we market things to an age segregated class, this sort of like fantasy of retirement. And so will you talk a little bit about that less virtuous side of how that kind of old age was marketed to people? And because I think part of what you're getting at, and is something, you know, I'm always trying to get it in my writing, is like the false bill of goods, like that so many people are being sold this vision of elder life that is actually not the ingredients for a happy, healthy existence, right?
Absolutely. In fact, there is when you think of, to try to find the turning point, this is one of those trends where you could actually find a particular day, January 1st, 1960, where everything changed. And that's the opening of Sun City, the first age-segregated retirement community in America that was built at a mass scale. And it was built around the idea of the golden years. Del Webb, who opened Sun City, had come up with that phrase, this idea that you could recapture your youth. And the central premise was marrying a second youth with radical age segregation. And they seem like they might be things that were independent of each other, but the central idea is that the key to this idea of you know, pretending that you were young again, what Betty Friedan called the youth short circuit, was the abject absence of actual young people.
Right.
If everybody was old, then nobody could be old. And it's interesting because even there was an idealistic root. In 1956, Lewis Mumford, one of the great urban scholars of the last century, described older people as the most rejected group in any society ever. Walter Reuther, the head of the UAW, had described retirees as too old to work, too young to die. And this sort of state of limbo, living out a season in search of a purpose. And even before Del Webb, a remarkable and very idealistic entrepreneur by the name of Big Ben Schleifer,
right?
Not exactly a household word in the way Del Webb, who was an immigrant to New York, who was Jewish and who was enamored of the kibbutz, visited a friend, an older friend, in a nursing home in upstate New York and decided that something had to be done about it. And so he created, in the middle of this godforsaken desert outside of Phoenix in Peoria, Arizona, the very first age-segregated community built around this ideal of youth, and it was called Youngtown. And it was going to be a kibbutz where older people could escape this pariah status and could kind of get with the program. They too could pretend they were young in a society that was so enamored with youth. And the 50s were the time the teenager was exploding on the scene. And Webb picked up that idea, and he was a genius at at taking things to Ovesco. He's the guy who invented the motel. He's the guy who built Las Vegas in the movie Bugsy. It's Del Webb's flamingo that Bugsy Siegel is building.
Wow.
He built all the Japanese internment camps in California, and when pressed about that, he just said a job's a job. But the idea came from Ben Schleifer, and it was, even though it started out with the best of intentions, and it caught on quickly on the day that January 1st, 1960, Webb and his lieutenants the night before had been together at a Mexican restaurant in Peoria, Arizona, wondering how they were going to sell a 30-year mortgage to somebody who's 65 years old, and they'd put $4 million into it. And the next morning, they woke up and 100,000 people showed up. You know, if you build it, they will come. And there was a traffic jam for 20 miles leading into Peoria, Arizona. But if you fast forward 30 years ahead, Youngstown had become a symbol of all of the grievous wound that I was talking about before. The community had banded together to eject a couple, grandparents, who were harboring their grandson who'd been abused and was escaping his father. They planted a sign on the lawn. It was like the Scarlet Letter, harboring children. Fine them $100 a day. The New York Times pointed out that dogs were allowed in Youngstown, but not children.
Yeah.
And so that, you know, understandable and somewhat idealistic notion of age segregation and recapturing a second youth had really soured by the 90s. And in fact, it was reported also by the New York Times that at Sun City, the biggest volunteer activity was the age police. People who were voluntarily following school buses around to make sure they weren't dropping any children off at Sun City.
Wow. That's amazing.
And so that, you know, that really, I think, and it turns out these age segregated retirement communities were also the prototype for the whole gated community idea.
Right.
So other entrepreneurs came in, they saw that there was money to be made out of segregation. And so it spread beyond age to other types of segregation as well.
I'm so struck by that idea, you know, the 20-mile traffic jam and the sort of them thinking like, will anyone sign up? And then they have, because on the one hand, I think, well, they must have done a hell of a marketing job like that. I mean, some of you might even remember that moment of that marketing. But the other thing is that it clearly was tapping into a deep and widely felt need of some kind. And it makes me think about that part of the golden years sort of fantasy is that you transcend like all the messy responsibility of the rest of your life. Like I'm almost 40 and kind of these middle years of like taking care of people and working and making money and like all of the mess that is, that there's something about this image that he painted that was like the goal of life is to transcend all that messiness. And mm-hmm. part of what you're saying is actually like, the messiness is the good stuff. Like stay in relationship. You don't necessarily have to stay in the money crunch or the craziness of those middle years, but that like transcending relationship is not what the golden years is about. Do you know what I mean?
I do. And you know, I'll say on behalf of the Del Webbs of the world that what they did successfully do was produce a kind of community, because a lot of older people who felt at that period excluded from the action in their home communities could go to a place where they could have a community of peers and they could escape the stigma of being old in a country that really did not know what to do with older people anymore.
Right. And so they were finding relationship.
Yes, but it was a relationship that was
exactly. Yeah.
And the vertical relationship was what suffered. And so I, you know, I want to be harshly critical, and I generally am, of that phenomenon. But I can understand why in that particular context it ended up flourishing, and you had traffic jams for 20 miles, and it really reshaped the American dream. The American dream became Instead of fearing retirement and later life as this land of this anteroom to the great beyond,
yeah.
You know, the Whistler's mother-like existence where you're supposed to rock aimlessly on the porch, it became the goal. People didn't want to retire at 65. They wanted to retire at 58 and scrambled and scrimped and saved so they could get to this shimmering version of success in later life.
So a decade of vacation.
Yes,
marketing of
Exactly. But I think a lot of it is this issue of how, when I first started writing the book and the title of How to Live Forever is trying to get at that. It was really an attempt to understand why we're running away from mortality, why we're running away from later life, why we've done it for so long. And I've came to think in the end that that places like Sun City and Youngtown were the kind of low-tech version of trying not to face our mortality, and now, you know, drive 30 miles south and you get the high-tech version where Silicon Valley is spending, by recent estimate, $45 billion to conquer mortality entirely. And so I think, that we need to do the opposite. We need to come to terms with our mortality, with this season at the end of life, and do it in a way that's not just at the very end, but that can give meaning to this period.
Right. And I want to return a little bit. You mentioned loneliness, but while we're still thinking about kind of the dangers and perils of age segregation, I think, like loneliness, I mean, it's a term we use to refer to an emotional state, but it's actually now becoming a clinical area that people are researching and with great health defects. And can you talk a little bit about this like explosion in loneliness and how you see it tied to age segregation?
Well, I think what you're referring to is, among other things, Vivek Murthy, who was Surgeon General under President Obama, wrote an article in Harvard Business Review 2 years ago arguing that loneliness was the single greatest public health epidemic facing America today. And there's research that shows that its equivalent in its adverse health effect to smoking, I think, 15 cigarettes a day. The UK has embraced this challenge and actually appointed a minister of loneliness, a cabinet level position.
Yeah.
And so I on the other side, one of the things that I've been struck by and that has really driven my work now for 30 years is the importance of relationship, the power of relationship. I started out focusing on mentoring for kids and essentially loneliness and social isolation in young people and the benefits of adult connection. I was involved in a study of the Big Brother Big Sister program, mm-hmm. which showed that young people who had a big brother or a big sister were 46% less likely to use drugs, 50% less likely to skip school, 33% less likely to engage in violent behavior. And that really reflected a whole body of research on children who were resilient, who managed to make it against the odds in poverty and in other adverse circumstances.
Yeah, one of our other local heroes, Nadine Burke-Harris, who
yes.
a lot of you are probably aware of, who talks about toxic stress and how it's just like one solid relationship with an adult can reverse and kind of maintain the health of...
Well, Yuri Bronfenbrenner, who was the co-founder of the Head Start program and one of the giants of child development over the last quarter century, has a beautiful expression. He says, what every child needs is at least one adult who's irrationally crazy about them.
I loved that line. When I read that in your book, I underlined it. I was like, that is so beautiful.
And you know what? I think one of the things I tried to... So you start out talking about how we're now at a point where, for the first time in American history, we've got more older people than younger people. 2019, first year, we'll have more people over 60 than under 18. And that's been seen as this source of conflict and scarcity, isolation. But in fact, if you shift the lens from, you know, fiscal strife and some political differences to human development, the needs and assets of generations really fit together like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. You've got Bronfenbrenner and all this research on resilient kids and studies like the Big Brother, Big Sister study. But if you look at research on well-being in later life, what it shows is that as we get older, as we realize there's less time ahead than behind, it drives a focus on relationship. If somebody tells you you've got 6 months left to live, you don't go out and start learning the oboe, Mandarin. You focus on relationships, on people, on connection. And Laura Carstensen at Stanford, our friend, has shown that's true at any point in life, but particularly true for older adults. So there's this impulse to connect as we get older, but we also get better at it. Emotional regulation, empathy, a whole set of the most important relationship skills blossom in later life, not for all people in later life, but writ large. And then the third thing that happens is that we are particularly driven to connect in ways that flow down the generational chain. The Harvard study of adult development, the most significant study of happiness in later life and adult life, has shown that older people who mentor and connect with younger people are three times as likely to be happy as those who fail to do so. George Valent, the psychiatrist at Harvard who led that study for 40 years, has this exquisite expression. He says it's not just an accident or a fluke, that it's part of human nature, that biology flows downhill. Mm-hmm. And so if, you know, what every child needs is at least one adult who's irrationally crazy about them, and now we have a population explosion of people who are not only numerous and have time, but who are driven to connect, good at it, to connect down the generational chain, Why aren't we bringing these two things together in a way where everybody benefits?
Right. Will you talk about the grandmother hypothesis? Because that was another thing that I just like underlined and thought was so interesting.
It's true. You know, I mean, in the current context, you know, it's easy to think of the generations as, you know, being crosswise, but developmentally, their needs fit together. But if you go back to the beginning of human history, it turns out that there's an evolutionary basis for this. There's a for years, a lot of male anthropologists wondered why women lived beyond menopausal age, right? And you know, why there was no, in the world of the harsh gene, you know, it didn't make any sense until an anthropologist at the University of Utah, Kristen
or
Hawk.
Or the world of the assholes, as I may put it. If you have a bunch of male anthropologists who can't figure out that there might be something other than procreative possibility. Anyway.
And so Kristen Hawk rode to the rescue, and she studied hunter-gatherer tribes in Tanzania and in South America, tried to focus on the role of older people, particularly older women. And what she discovered is it's the role of older women nurturing children that enabled hunter-gatherer parents, both parents, to go out and gather. And that's what is the kind of key ingredient in the long gestational period that separates humans from all other species. So,
some grandmothers in the room who are like, yep.
So I think the question is, you know, how do we adapt the grandmother hypothesis to the modern family world?
Right. Which, and I know, in some ways people are, right? I mean, there are probably a lot of people in this audience who feel like they are taking care of small children while a different generation does the hunting and gathering, right? Like the proverbial hunting and gathering. I think some of us are doing this in fits and starts within our own familial structures, but yet we still don't have a broader picture of this. And I was thinking about like one of the tasks ahead, which is what you're trying to do in your book, is how do we paint a picture of intergenerational interaction as vivid and as accessible as what, you know, Webb was able to do with the golden years? Like what is the... what is the cultural shift that helps people really see themselves into this? And part of what you did for the book was you traveled all over the world and throughout the U.S. to try to capture what this actually looks like. Will you talk a little bit about particularly maybe Singapore and the U.K. first in terms of examples?
I went to those two places back to back, which produced, I think, the the 2018 record for jet lag.
Well, yeah, I can't
imagine. But this whole phenomenon that we're talking about is global. All throughout Asia, in Japan, South Korea, in Europe, Italy, France, Spain, they're already well into the more old than young society. In many of those places, between 40% and 50% of the population is going to be over 60 by mid-century. So I wanted to find out what we could learn from some of these places. And I went first to Singapore because in true Singaporean fashion, they've come up with this extraordinary, comprehensive, grand plan to create what they call a kampung for all ages. And kampung is the Malay word for village, mm-hmm. Built around the idea of intergenerational harmony. And it's both soaring in its aspiration, but ruthlessly practical and based on things that are working around the globe. And it's also handsomely funded. Singapore is a place of 4 million people, so about the size of Chicago area. And they're putting $3 billion into this plan to do it. And every senior center and preschool are going to be co-located in Singapore. The housing that's being built is being designed from the get-go to bring generations together, families, but also they have three-gen flats, but also unrelated older and younger people. I visited a church there, an Anglican church near the National University of Singapore, where they were building an assisted living facility, but were pressured by the government to intensify the value of the land where this was going to be built. So they added a 200-person preschool. And so much of it is built around the idea of proximity, of how do we bring people close to each other in daily life so that these kinds of bonds that are natural can happen naturally. I then went to the UK, where a remarkable journalist, a woman named Lucy Kellaway from the Financial Times, who's a revered figure in the UK, wrote a column 2 years ago saying at the age of 58 that she, a year from that point, would no longer be writing her column, but would be teaching math or maths mm-hmm. in front of a low-income classroom in London. And she was inspired by her daughter, who went to the British equivalent of Teach for America, Teach First. Mm. And she then did something that none of the wonderful role models here, whether they're Jimmy Carter or Bill Gates or, you know, all of these people who are doing great things in later life, she challenged her peers to join her, that mm-hmm. to quit their jobs and to start teaching in science and math. And 1,000 people came forward. They originally had 20 slots. There were 50 people in their 50s, 60s, 70s who were competing for every slot. And it became a national phenomenon in the way that Teach for America did here in the U.S. when it was first launched. And I think it just showed the inchoate yearning of so many older people to do something rather than trying so hard to be young, to be there for those who actually are.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking, as I think about my own daughter's classroom or something, like to be a classroom teacher takes a tremendous amount of energy. And so I feel like one of the things that your work has been so revolutionary around is saying, like, you can have an encore career that is a full-time thing, like going back into the classroom, but mm-hmm. there are also a lot of different ways to keep staying engaged and be purposeful without having a really intense full-time job, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that kind of the prototype for everything that we've been doing really started with Experience Corps, which
yeah.
was an attempt a little bit like what Lucy Kellaway was doing at the time when AmeriCorps was being launched with a focus on engaging young people in service, to make that same call to action to the older population. And now, I think this year, Experience Corps members are serving 30,000 kids. And the program, it's 20 hours a week, and people get a stipend. It's now run by AARP, and it's been remarkably successful. And one of the I mean, the research from Johns Hopkins Medical School, from Washington University in St. Louis has shown benefits for the kids that are equivalent to a dramatic reduction in class size, but for the older adults, tremendous gains in well-being. In fact, there's new research from Hopkins Medical School that suggests that it actually reverses the preconditions of dementia. But then there were all kinds of other things that came out that weren't even part of the program design, where the Experience Corps members, most of whom were African American and Latino, who'd come from the neighborhoods where the kids, in many cases, had gone to the same schools, were mentoring the teachers because they were the only other adult in the classroom, a stable presence. And so it became a program just infused in relationship. The Experience Corps members form bonds amongst themselves. They connect with the young people. They work with the teachers. And the mutuality is really strong. One story that I keep thinking about from 20 years ago in Philadelphia, at the Taylor Elementary School, an Experience Corps member named Martha Jones mm-hmm. was telling me that she, on a cold, miserable Philadelphia February morning, wasn't feeling well, was a little depressed, and didn't want to get out of bed and go down to the Taylor Elementary School. And she started thinking about the kids and how she would be missed, but she got back in bed. She, you know, didn't feel up to it, but then they kept tugging at her, and so she got dressed and got in her car, drove to the school, and she was hanging up her coat in the classrooms. It's kind of 1920s building, and as she's hanging up her coat, she described feeling these two little arms crawling up behind her. She said, "Somebody loves me." And so, you know, there were plenty of stories like that, but there was also, you know, been pretty significant research to show that in the motto of the Foster Grandparent Program, which is another program that does this kind of work, every dollar is spent twice.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, back to our program.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, so one of the barriers to getting people to do this kind of, you know, cross-generational, you know, edification is programmatic, right? Is like people don't know where to go and how to, you know, do you show up at your like neighborhood elementary school and say like, does anyone need my help? You know, they're already stressed and don't know how to channel you. So one of the things is these programmatic things. But I wonder what you think the deeper psychological barriers are. Because I've been thinking about, I'm actually someone who has always been attracted to intergenerational relationships. From the time I was like in my teens and 20s, I've always been interested in befriending and being mentored by older people. And I've seen that for some of my peers, that was definitely not, they were not compelled to do it. And I've it's hard to study yourself, but I'm kind of like, why was I okay with that? I'm like, maybe it's because of my relationship with my parents. I have a fairly positive relationship with my parents. And I knew one side of my grandparents, not the other side. But do you think there's something going on where people like, What prevents young people and older people from psychologically being open and pursuing these kind of relationships?
Yeah, well, I think that the age segregation issue is a big problem. You know, so many people just don't grow up with much contact with different generations, and so that leads to misconceptions, to stereotype, to ageism. Yeah. And then I think just culturally, we've kind of lost a sense of the cycle of life and the natural benefits of connecting in this way. And, you know, I kept thinking, as I was writing the book, I was thinking about it, you know, why if all the developmental literature tells us that this is, you know, fundamental part of being human, that we need to do this not just to connect supply and demand, not just for efficiency, but for humanity,
yeah.
How have we lost that? And I would take walks while I was writing the book. And, you know, as you mentioned, we both live in the East Bay. And I was walking along this Strawberry Creek in Berkeley, and I remembered that that Strawberry Creek was the result of the stream restoration project where it had been covered over entirely, and then some visionary architects in the 70s and 80s raised awareness, and they uncovered the creek, and now there are, you know, sounds of water and greenery and wild turkeys, and and I almost feel like we need the cultural version of that, because this you know, biology does flow downhill, but society needs to as well. Culture needs to as well. We need a cultural equivalent to the golden years ideal that's around connecting down the generational chain and get kind of realigned with human nature, because it's like we rerouted the river of life and now we need to return it to its natural course. And then we need to be, as I was saying before, as creative around bringing people together and creating proximity as we have been around splitting them apart. And I think, you know, some of that are things that we can do in our own lives. And I'm struck, and I, you know, in our conversations about your experience at Temescal Commons, maybe you could just tell a little bit about that, because you made this choice not to live in an age bubble, to live in a community that was going to have people of different generations. And I know that that's made a big difference in the life of your family.
Yeah. And maybe as, you know, rooted in my initial attraction, as I was saying, throughout my 20s to be in all these intergenerational relationships. When my husband and I moved from New York to the Bay Area, we moved into a co-housing community, which is intergenerational. So there's about 25 people. The youngest is probably like a 5-month-old now. And the eldest is my 80-year-old neighbor, Louise, who I've written about a little bit and is actually in the book, because Mark was like, here's an example of a great intergenerational relationship. And Louise is a single woman, interestingly, a single woman who never had kids. So the alternative for what her life would look like is very different from what her life looks like now. We eat together twice a week. So we have our own homes that have everything a typical home would have, but we also have a shared industrial-sized kitchen and eating area where we get together and eat twice a week. And we have a shared garden that Louise is the total guru of, and I've learned so much from her on that. We have a shared bike shed, you know, just sort of some of those amenities that people would privately own, we share. But we also have our own kitchens, just to be clear. So it's, there's a lot of private life, and then there is the shared life too. And the reciprocity of the generations is just like, it's bears out exactly what you're saying. All the anthropology and developmental psychology proves, you know, it's Louise is teaching my two young daughters how to garden, totally outside of my skill set. I can help her with, you know, a computer issue or talk to her. She's a writer also, actually. So we have a lot in common, and I can talk to her about sort of more contemporary forms of publishing online, or, you know, we have those kinds of conversations. So there's just all of this very natural and very unstructured exchange that happens because of the proximity, which is one of the points of your book. And I've written a little bit about co-housing because sadly it came to the US 25 years ago, and there are only about 160 co-housing communities in America. So it has not exploded at anything like the rate that you would think would meet the demand of people who say, I would love to live in a more interdependent, intergenerational way. And part of that's financing and structuring and the failure of urban planning and architecture and all these things. And so I think this is where I get a little sort of sad and almost cynical of, like, I believe so much in this message and I've tried to live it myself, but it feels like there aren't enough structural, you know, structural innovations happening for people. Like, even if everyone in this room is like, I want to live that way.
Right.
It's like you could seek out some of these programs and have these beautiful relationships that you were talking about at various schools, but to actually live in a non-age segregated way is very hard to access. I mean, I don't know if people in the room feel that way, but I feel like it's, you know, it's still so rare to find. People can do it in their neighborhoods, obviously, like you wrote about that in your book too.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was one of the, I have to admit, I came back from Singapore with their massive society-wide effort, you know, partly the kind of investment, the $3 billion that's going into it, was impressive, but mostly this kind of sense of common purpose in recapturing this kampong for all ages.
Yeah.
There was a cultural vision as well. And then even going to the UK and seeing this movement of now teach members who had come forward and thinking about where things stand in the U.S. and even more because it turns out that JFK had this beautiful vision all these many years ago. In 1963, he gave his most important speech on aging, and he said, "We'd added years to life. Now it was time to add life to those years." And since that time, we've added 2 months a year on average to the American lifespan. So we've been doing great on that front. But in terms of a cultural vision, a multi-generational vision, we've really floundered. And he had this idea of a national core of older adults who would invest in the next generation, who would be preschool teachers, who would work in playgrounds. And it kind of got lost. And I feel like where we're at now is, on the positive side, the U.S., I think, is a very rich laboratory where there's this kind of great ferment of experiments going on that I think create a picture of where we could be. One of my favorite examples, it kind of reminds me of Temescal Commons, is Judson Manor in Cleveland, which is a senior living facility near the Cleveland Clinic, near all the Case Western University, the main cultural institutions in Cleveland, which several years ago decided, because it was filled with culture-loving older people, to provide free rent to graduate students at the local Cleveland Institute for Music. So they provided rooms for 7 students, free rent, in return for playing concerts. So started out, you know, let's focus on music. And then this whole other beautiful web of relationships developed. When I was there, I met a woman who whose neighbor had been a young viola student who married another young viola student at from the Institute of Music. And when it came time for their wedding, they asked their 90-year-old neighbor to be the maid of honor.
Oh, that's so awesome.
And, you know, and so I think that It kind of reminds me almost of like grass popping up between the sidewalk.
Yeah.
Of, you know, when we do find these creative ways to bring people together, whether it's at Temescal Commons or Judson Manor, or I think the Rainbow Childcare Program in Little Havana, which started out as a senior center where older women, mostly from Cuba, in the Little Havana section, were bringing their kids, their grandkids along. But because of federal regulations, they couldn't receive meals at this senior center. So they created a preschool there staffed entirely by older women.
Yeah.
And you know, it's these relationships have flourished. And so I think where we're at now, in fact, when I went to Judson Manor, I was shocked because encountered an entire contingent of Swedish social scientists who were coming to Cleveland in November to get ideas for social innovation.
Yeah.
So I think one of the things we are right now seeing, you know, an extraordinary blossoming of ideas, but how do we take them to scale in our daily lives so that this interaction happens? But there are some great things, like in higher education, you know, one of the most age-segregated arenas, there are now a proliferation of programs where people in their 60s and 70s are going back to school. It started at Harvard, and then Stanford has done a version of it. But now other universities, the University of Minnesota has a program called UMAC, where people come in their 60s mostly for a year back to the university to get a new stage of education. And they're age integrating the classrooms of the university. I went there to a future of work class where a young woman told me she couldn't figure out why all these, you know, 60 and 70 year olds were in her future of work class, and then she realized that they actually had worked.
So it was pretty helpful to have them around.
Yeah. So, you know, I said, and in work, we have a program, as you mentioned, called the Encore Fellows Program, which is a little bit like the movie The Intern, but in real life, where people who finish their midlife career come and spend a year in a nonprofit and oftentimes mentor the executive director. So So, you know, we're seeing this kind of ferment, but how do we take it to a level where it becomes the norm and not just, you know, exciting stories?
And also, how do we transcend, you know, the people who came to this room obviously have an interest in this topic. You and I love talking about this, but we're kind of like fish in water where it's like, how do we get urban planners and, you know, all these people who this may not be top of mind for, to be thinking about the long-term implications of like how we design cities, how we think about the lifespan of education, you know, how do we transcend out of these bubbles to like really get people outside of the choir excited about it? Like, are you feeling like this book is reaching some of those people, or do you have schemes for how to get some of those people on board?
You know, I have been heartened as I've been going to different communities, how many people who are interested in education and the built environment, they're and even in the natural world, this is starting to happen. So for example, right now, you know, you hear all these concerns about the tension between boomers and millennials, but in fact, it's a love fest. In the Pew Research Center has been polling around generational attitudes towards each other, and they've never seen such positive views between older and younger people. Right now, they're the highest levels of older and younger people living together in families since the 1940s. And people say, oh, that's because of the downturn in 2008. But actually, as the economy rebounded, the numbers went up further. So I think that there
and
is...
And the psychological studies showed people were happier in those.
Exactly. So, houses, you know, right? It goes... And,
even
you know,
the White House, not this version. But the last version was multi-generational.
That's right? True. That's true.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I actually think that there's, you mentioned the White House, there is a chance of political alliance around this. One of my heroes and a person I wrote about in the book is a woman named Maggie Kuhn, who founded the Gray Panthers and who was a pioneer in multi-generational living. She had two houses in the Germantown section of Philadelphia, and she was a great rabble-rouser. In fact, she's... her gravestone says, "Here lies Maggie Kuhn under the only stone she left unturned." And at the same time, Ben Sasse, the conservative senator from Nebraska, wrote a book last year, The Vanishing American Adult, in which he has a whole chapter entitled Flee Age Segregation. In fact, you could take quotes from Ben Sasse and Maggie Kuhn, who probably agree on little, and it would be hard to figure out which to attribute them to. So I'm hoping, you know, for a whole set of reasons, you know, that this ferment of innovation, this natural affinity between the generations that goes against the grain of a lot of what we hear in the media, but also just the simple fact that, you know, unlike a lot of other divisions, young people quickly become older people.
Right.
And so there's built-in self-interest and maybe even the possibility of bridging divides. So I think we can fix this. And I think in the process, it can fix us.
That's beautiful. I don't want to neglect your questions because I know you have a lot of them. And I think I'm going to get... Oh, perfect. Okay. I have 9 million other questions, but I don't want to neglect yours. Let's see. So intergenerational programs are great. Hi, Mark. Actually, this started with, hi, Mark, with an exclamation point. Intergenerational programs are great, but how can more of us create our own intergenerational reality in our own lives? So from a really pragmatic perspective, like for the folks in this room, what are the ways that they can seek out these kinds of relationships?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think picking up on something you said earlier, I think we do need, we have to start by recognizing that there's a lot of self-interest in this, that we need these kinds of bonds. They, you know, that the real fountain of youth isn't in some test tube in Silicon Valley. The real fountain of youth is the fountain with youth. You know, it's through these kinds of connections. Eric Erickson had this beautiful, he said, the hallmark of successful development in later life could be encapsulated in the phrase, I am what survives of me. So I think it starts with realizing that there's a lot in this for us. And then I think it's I think trying to make sure that we do everything we can in our daily life to put ourselves in settings where we're going to encounter younger generations, mm-hmm. whether it be workplaces or places like you're living or Judson Manor, or even the neighborhood that we choose, the kind of volunteer work that we do. So it all needs to, I think that needs to be one of the things that we think about. And then I think that there are a lot of skills around these connections that we can practice. One of my mentors was John Gardner, who came up with the original idea for Experience Corps, and he taught me a lot of things. But one of the things I remember him saying is that everybody wants to be interesting. The real skill is actually being interested. And he taught himself how to be a better listener. And
yeah.
I remember this from the research on mentoring. It was the mentors who listened, who formed the most powerful bonds with young people. So I think starts with an understanding of the importance of this in our own well-being, being proximate, being in settings where we are going to encounter other generations in daily life, and then learning to be good elders is critical as well.
That's such a beautiful phrase. It reminds me, one of my other elder friends and mentors is a guy named Parker Palmer, whose work people may have known about, an amazing Quaker thinker and writer. And he often talks about, he's like one of the best listeners I know, and talks a lot about the idea that elders often come to the relationship feeling a lot of pressure to be like transmitting some specific kind of wisdom. And so he kind of walks around this idea of no fixing, no saving, no advising. And like in his own head, when he's interacting with a young person, if he's directly asked for advice, he'll give it. But he sees his role as really just listening and reflecting back and mirroring back and, you know, potentially sharing a story from his own life, but not in this intense way, which I think the elders that I see most successful at having intergenerational relationships adopt that in some form. They don't feel some pressure to like have that golden nugget that's going to transform the person's life. Mm-hmm. And I also feel like one of the things I will often tell young people who are asking me, like, how do you get a mentor, is I'll just be like, it's not sexy. Just be useful. Like,
yes.
Be someone who shows up and says, you seem like you could use some help, like figuring out how to like do this thing on the internet. Can I be of use to you? And I actually think it works in reverse, right? Like, as someone who is in that tough moment of having two small children and a big job and all this stuff going on, like when Louise can say to me like, hey, you want me to do art with your 5-year-old for an hour? And I'm like, yes, thank you. You know, like that bonds us. Cause it's like, I'm so grateful for her usefulness. And mm-hmm. So I think if you're in a neighborhood and you just notice that someone's like of my age needs some help, like, you know, we really need the help,
yes,
you
yes.
know? Can you speak to the high societal reverence we place on youth, particularly through media?
Hmm. I think that's been one of the real barriers to figuring this out. You know, I think I said earlier that this period in life has been described as a season in search of a purpose. And I think what, by way of context, what's happening more broadly in the society, there are demographic changes, more old than young. There are changes in life expectancy. Half the young people born in the developed world since 2000 are projected to see their 100th birthday. So, but I think we're also, it's not just the length of life or the demographics of society that's changing, it's the map of life. And we need, there's a period that's opening up between midlife and anything resembling old age that is very much like the creation of adolescence 100 years mm-hmm. ago. And it turns out that the person who created adolescence is psychologist G. Stanley Hall, in his own later life, said he'd made a mistake. He should have never invented teenagers.
Really?
He should have created this new stage of life between midlife and old age. And he described it as an Indian summer and said that human beings didn't reach the height of their capacity until the shadows started slanting eastward. Mm. And by that, I think he meant that we reach this juncture in life where they're, you know, fewer years ahead than behind, where we realize that mortality is in the picture. And yet we have the capacity to do something with that. And it was truly one of the sweet spots in life. You know, in the past, you know, lots of times when we reached the point where we, you know, understood what matters most, we were either too rejected or too worn out to do much with it. But now I think we have a population explosion of people who are in this period, and we need a culture that goes with that. You know, it's like our culture has been stuck in a focus on youth and youth being the goal, even to the point where the goal for later life became a kind of ersatz second childhood. Yeah. And we need to come up with what the goal and purpose is for this stage of life. And I think the place to look is in human development and what that has to tell us. And it is through not trying to live forever, literally, not trying to be the next generation, but to invest in those who will follow us. And that's a cultural norm in every faith tradition. I remember at my own father's funeral last year, the rabbi told the story of from the Talmud of a rabbi who comes across an old man planting an acorn, and, you know, skeptically says, "Old man, you know, why are you planting this acorn? You're never going to be around long enough to see it come up." And he said, "You know, I spent my whole life under the shade of oak trees that others had planted, and that's why I'm planting this." And there's a Greek proverb, "Society grows great when older people plant trees under whose shade they shall never sit." And so that's what we need to embrace, mm-hmm. not a second youth or living to 150.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we were talking about this backstage. It might bear mentioning about, like, the cover story of one of the cover stories in the New York Times today was about older women. You know, the question was about media, and it does seem like people are starting to notice that there's this generation of women in their, like, early 70s and late 60s who, like Glenn Close, making this amazing speech. And, you know, there is sort of a bit of a cultural rumbling of, like, powerful older women saying, like, we're going to be visible and we're going to make great work and we're going to embrace our power, right?
Absolutely. This article today, I'm sure many of you saw it, was about this convergence of so many older women who are breaking extraordinary ground. Nancy Pelosi, 78, is once again Speaker of the House, but Donna Shalala, 78, also as a freshman congresswoman from Florida. Glenn Close just won the Best Actress Award at the Golden Globes at age 71. The new head of CBS News, the first woman to lead CBS News, Susan Zirinsky, is 66. And I don't think it's an accident. You know, you were mentored and continue to be mentored by Gloria Steinem, who's written about being 60 and being 70 and beyond. Betty Friedan wrote the wonderful book, The Fountain of Age. That whole generation of feminists and women who broke ground in the gender arena are now doing it around age as well, and really leading the way. And so I think there's a lot that us males could learn from that. Mm. Although I would say one other recommendation. I don't know if how many of you have seen the Kaminsky Method, which also won the other night. Mm-hmm. And I think it both showed the potential of these new roles, but also the challenges. And there's a heartbreaking scene in one of the episodes where Michael Douglas is having a rough day, and he's walking through the park and he sees these kids playing at a playground. It's this bucolic scene, and he goes over and sits on the park bench, and the mothers call the police. Right. We have some cultural ground to break.
Right. Well, I think you and I haven't even talked about that. I've noticed this trend of incredibly involved grandfathers, and my sense is that it is this second chance for a lot of men of saying, like, yes, in many ways, I wanted to be a really present father, but I kind of missed the boat because I still stuck to some pretty conventional norms of who would do the caretaking. And now I have this second chance to be involved in a small kid's life. And I think it's really beautiful. Here's another great question. How have the religious institutions played a role in this division? Modern life is increasingly secular, and synagogues, churches, and mosques are institutions where elders would exist vibrantly with the rest of the community.
Yeah, I think that there's a critical role for faith institutions to play. And, you know, in that story I was telling about the church in Singapore where they were building a new senior living facility and a preschool together, in the process of doing it, they realized that the church had become radically age segregated. They had children's services and services for young families, and then services that, you know, drew more older people. And this project forced them to rethink how they were structured. But I think even more important potentially is, I mean, we've got all these rites of passage to go from being adolescents to being adults. But there are few moving into this new stage of life, this Indian summer, where the shadow starts slanting eastward. And I think, you know, especially given how much mortality is weighing on people, there's a need for faith institutions to help people navigate their way into a new sense of purpose that embraces this period. And I've been working with a group of rabbis, including a woman named Laura Geller in Los Angeles, to create sort of the equivalent of a bar mitzvah for people in their 60s.
Really?
That's built around the idea of planting trees under whose shade we won't ever actually sit.
Wow.
So we have to hire Louise to plant those trees.
That's so cool.
She's the gardener exemplar.
I'm so heartened that you're doing that, because I feel like when we have these gaps, getting back to even like the creation of the web place, it's like the market will step in. So like, you know, people do ridiculous things like have baby moons now, like before you're going to have your baby, you go on a baby moon, or, you know, there's always like a marketing ploy that will step into these gaps. So it's, I don't want to see like this is a very particular kind of vacation that you take at this, specific age,
right,
versus like a really truly like wholesome and spiritual rite of passage experience that is not like captured by the market, but is like a real thing for people. Seems like such a beautiful. So when is this going to be debuted?
This coming Saturday. No. I should put in a plug for a friend and colleague and fellow San Franciscan, Chip Conley, who founded the Joie de Vivre hotel chain. He has a new book out called Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder. That tells about his experience of retiring from Joie de Vivre and then going to Airbnb, where he mentored the founders of Airbnb, but also was essentially a beginner learning this whole different realm. And he has now set up a modern elder academy in Mexico, where you can get sunshine and rites of passage all as part of one deal. So it sounds like an extraordinary effort.
Awesome. Let's see, I have time for a couple more. With our new governor, who appears to be open to progressive ideas, have you thought of approaching him about some of these ideas? Mm. Senior centers and preschools, he wants to establish free preschool in California, et cetera. Mm-hmm. He also has we have a first lady, you know, she's also incredibly powerful and progressive and interested in breaking down various, you know, like masculinity and stereotypes and it would be quite the couple on intergenerational issues, right?
Absolutely. And you know, and I think this huge investment that the new governor is planning on early childhood education raises the question of where are the human beings that go with the dollars to provide that kind of support. So I think we're hoping, I'd love to see a national legacy corps that is becomes that kind of right of passage for older people that's focused on the early childhood years. And I'd love to see California pioneer that and as a model where people, kind of a gap year for grownups, but focused on developing the next generation. So I'd love to have an audience with the governor. I'm actually, as it turns out, I'm going in 2 weeks to do an interview with a former First Lady of the state, Maria Shriver. And I'm looking forward to that because her father, the great Sergeant Shriver, created the Foster Grandparent Program, which was part of the War on Poverty and involves older women and men 20 hours a week from low-income backgrounds working one-on-one with children. And I had the chance to interview him before he died. And I asked him, what the inspiration was for it and whether he thought it actually worked. And he went fishing around his desk and pulled out a black ashtray in which he had all the War on Poverty programs and showed me that foster grandparents and Head Start were stenciled next to each other. And I love the idea that an ashtray was the artifact of, one of the great social innovation campaigns. But he told me that it worked because it was simple, it was one-on-one, and because it was human. It was about relationship. And so I plan to remind her of that.
That's so beautiful. Tale. I love that. And she's been such an incredible champion of visibilizing caretaking, which is mm-hmm. one of the big threads of this whole conversation. Is like, we don't want to deal with death, but we also invisibilize caretaking. So that both things lead to mm-hmm. age segregation or sort of the privatization of any kind of caretaking. We think, like, mm-hmm. we'll just pay for it, like, let's not talk about it, and underpay for it, as it is with so many of these jobs. So it's cool that their legacies, it does feel like she's really, mm-hmm. speaking of the acorn,
yes,
pulling through a lot of his beautiful work. So we are ending our time together, but I do want this crew here to leave with, like, a really practical sense of, like, when they go home tonight or when they wake up tomorrow, like, what is the thing that they can do that will mean they are part of this movement? Like, is it about literally, like, knocking on a neighbor's door? Is it about looking up if some of these programs that we've mentioned exist around them? Are there any other, like, deeply practical things that you'd leave people with?
I would close with the theme of proximity. Be proximate and plant trees.
Literally, maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah. Well, and you don't have to wait for him and the rabbi to figure out the rite of passage. Like, if you and your own communities want to, like, set up some moment, some way of honoring that passage, I think that would be cool, too. And write him about it so he'll know what you did, right? That's awesome. Well, thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you.
And thank you, all of you, for being here. I forgot I have a job. I have a very official thing I'm supposed to say. Okay. I'm Courtney Martin, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. I almost forgot my closing.